So it was during the hot and humid rainy season of 1943 that the Provincial Commission of Ndola vented his frustration in a letter to the Chief Secretary of the Colonial Government of Northern Rhodesia, which is now the Zambia. He wrote, "The habit of changing name on every possible occasion is becoming an absolute pest, and is against the best interest of the Africans themselves. It is sometimes done because the owner thinks he may wish sometime or other to cover up his tracks. I'm particularly keen on devising some system of establishing identity a part of the pass law, but I should like it to be uniform for the territory." Of course, when changing one's name in a context of taxation, exploitative labor migration, and forced labor, whether changing one's name in a context of taxation, exploitative labor migration, and forced labor is in the best interest of the Africans themselves is a matter of debate, to say the least. What the provincial commissioner referred to in his letter was the great difficulty faced by the colonial administration in making the different types of written registration and identification compatible with each other. In other words, the colonial administrators in Northern Rhodesia, the troublesome challenge was to permanently make stick one name and one name only to a given person. When confronted with the subversive strategies of Africans to evade entanglements in the emergent bureaucratic system, colonial administrators came up with creative solutions, and some of them even posed as ardent defenders of African tradition. In a follow-up to the letter by the provincial commissioner of Ndola, his colleague from Central Province gave an example of this habit of changing names. "There's a growing tendency on the part of modern youth to drop the childhood name, which tendency I consider should not be encouraged. For instance, a man called John Chisenga has a son who is given the birth name of Kalunga. As a youth, Kalunga adopts the name of Isaac. His full name should be Isaac Kalunga Chisenga, but he thinks it grand to call himself Isaac John, and he probably becomes registered as such. Inevitably, if this trend is allowed to become general, Africa will be peopled by bicycle, ticket, football, and native names will be forgotten. It would be a tragedy if such actually happened. I consider it would be an excellent thing if all clerks engaged in the work of registering would be instructed not to accept such names as Isaac John when forwarding applications for identity certificates." Ironically, administrative necessities were here suggested, restricting the cultural hybridity that prevailed in the newly established industrial areas in the colony in order to retrieve an African identity. Unequivocal and authentic African names appear to guarantee a similarly unequivocal bureaucratic colonial type of registration. Similar to what Gert Spittler already in the 70s has described for the colonial bureaucracy in French West Africa, the administration in Northern Rhodesia thus faced difficulties in bureaucratically inscribing subjects into existing power relations. They failed to inscribe clearly identifiable subjects into what Michel Foucault has aptly called networks of writing. This network engages people in a whole mass of documentic, bureaucratic inscriptions that capture and fix them, entangling their lives in documents that are systematically connected with each other. For instance, people living in Germany in this audience are familiar with the fact that legalized labor in this country requires an income tax card. Yet these cards can only be obtained if there's official documentation of one's place of residence, which in turn presupposes an identity card, and so on. Networks of writing like these make sure that people in Germany find it exceedingly difficult to evade the grip of the state, should they wish to do so. But there are also other reasons for why bureaucracy is often said to be endowed with powerful agency. Among many other things, bureaucracy is about means, ends, rationality, formalization and normalization. It subdues people's identities in everyday lives into grids of classification that erase specificities and idiosyncrasies. The bureaucrat, on the other hand, does not really speak for himself or herself, but acts in the name of a higher order, which allows the bureaucrats to deflect personal responsibility and remain indifferent towards what is administered by him or her, even if this means exercising some form of structural violence. Yet, while all of this can be said to be true, in many or even most instances, there's also another side to the picture. For example, in the recent past, anthropologists have increasingly become aware of the fact that bureaucratic practices are not just enacted by representatives of the state, with citizens and subaltern populations always and necessarily on the receiving side. Instead, in many parts of the present-day world, bureaucratization has reached almost all areas of social life, including fields of activity that aim at counteracting a hegemonic state. Craig Hetherington has recently shown how peasant activists in Paraguay have adopted bureaucratic ways of arguing when engaging in land politics, thus making bureaucracy a weapon against the state. Also, my own research in Zambia and South Africa provides evidence for the existence of bureaucracy in areas of life where one would least expect them, namely in spirit-led charismatic movements, as well as among vigilante groups that are usually associated with spontaneous mob violence. What is more and most important for the topic of this plenary session, characterizing bureaucracy as an all-powerful apparatus that petrifies the world by reducing its ambiguities, contradictions, and flux, would only tell half of the story. Like it or not, street-level bureaucracy is also a site of creativity that provides social actors with discursive and practical registers to navigate the world. I have no doubt that all of us have some experience of encounters with bureaucrats where discretionary leeway and social negotiability eventually prevailed over bureaucratic standards. My personal experience in this regard was a policeman in Berlin who actually co-authored a crime witness report with me, telling me exactly what statement from my side would lead to what specific criminal charge by prosecutors and allowing me to change my statement accordingly. It is a really great pleasure for me to welcome the speakers of our plenary session, all of whom have made important contributions to the anthropology of bureaucracy. Our first speaker, Matthew Howe, from the University of Michigan, has become one of the most prominent protagonists in this field of study. Among his publications are the book Government of Paper, The Materiality of Bureaucracy in Urban Pakistan, as well as an extended review article entitled Documents and Bureaucracy, published in the Annual Review of Anthropology in 2012. The second speaker here in the middle, Colin Hope, teaches anthropology at Smith College and is very well known for his work on the immigration bureaucracy in South Africa. We explore the ambiguous condition of hope and despair experienced by people engaged in bureaucratic counters, as well as the technologies that produce and manage this ambiguity. Also, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome legal anthropologist Mia Halmetur-Mosari from the Helsinki Collegium of Advanced Studies, who is presently engaged in a fascinating project on the UN Human Rights Commission that addresses many of the issues discussed in this plenary session. So I'm looking forward to the paper. Welcome again, and